in association with iFanboy. Welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress, and it's time for part two of the Rucka debrief. Writer Greg Rucka joined us this week to talk about the Queen and Country novel, The Last Run, which just came out this week from Bantam Books. You'll hear more about the novel in part one of our conversation. In part two, we do discuss Queen and Country, given the fact that at the end of this story, Greg says he reaches the end of volume one, so it gives us the opportunity to look back at a lot of his collaborators on this series for the last 9 years. But one of the reasons we needed a part two was there was still a matter of getting to some of your questions that you have for Greg. You'll hear more about Greg's new novel series that starts in 2011, Alpha. You'll hear about potential digital plans for Greg's work for Oni Press. And we get more details about Greg's passion project with artist Rich Burkett, American Soldier. Of course, there's always more time about the writing process. Some of your questions reflected those subjects. Greg talks about those in this edition of the Rucka Debrief on Word Balloon. Today, it's sponsored by Audible.com. For you, the listeners of Word Balloon, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 14-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. Now, Greg has several audiobooks available from Audible. You know about his Atticus Kodiak series. You can get the last two Kodiak novels from Audible.com. You can get Walking Dead and Patriot Acts, and those are both narrated by Jonathan Davis of BBC Audio. We talk a little bit about that in today's episode. You can get one of those books absolutely free, and even if you decide that you don't like the 14-day trial at Audible, that book is yours to keep, so it's a great deal, and it's a great way to enjoy a Greg Rucka story. To download your free audiobook today, go to audiblepodcast.com/wordballoon. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/wordballoon for your free audiobook. Now, one note as we start our interview with Greg, being the political junkie that Greg is and that I am, the conversation turn to the coming midterm elections. Not in any specifics about any of the candidates, but the general idea that we live in a highly partisan environment. Still, some listeners just want to hear about comics. So for those of you who would like to pass on the political portion of our discussion, you may want to skip from about 22 minutes and 18 seconds in and come back at 30 minutes and 55 seconds. We welcome you back and go right on to our talk answering fan questions. So without further ado, here's part two of the Rucka Debrief right here on Word Balloon. We got so many good questions that I didn't want to limit us to just five. And also, we ended up covering a lot of questions that people had asked in the first part anyway. I think you did.
You are a deft interviewer.
No, you did it on your own in some cases. Oh, I mean, okay. You know, people wanted to know.
I'm a rambling fool, then.
Well, they wanted to know what was next, you know, things like that, specific future plans for Stumptown and Queen and Country. So I think we did a good job in covering those. But there were a few more. Before we get to those, I want to ask about Alpha and your new relationship with Mulholland.
Yeah,
and specifically your new editor, because you sound incredibly enthusiastic about working with this new editor.
Yeah, I think John's fantastic. He is. He makes me feel my age, actually, which is weird because when I got in, you know, when my first novel sold, I was 24, so I was an enfant, you know, terrible for a while, and when I met my first editor. There had been a BoucherCon in Seattle just after I had signed with Bantam, and I signed, and the convention started that Friday. So, like, I hopped in the car, and we were living in Eugene, and I drove up, and my editor at Bantam was a woman named Kate Misiak, and she would get, and as far as I know, she still does this. She will attend a BoucherCon, but she doesn't actually attend the BoucherCon. What she does is she gets a suite at a hotel, a very nice hotel, and then you schedule appointments and you get to come and see her. And it's kind of like going to court, you know? I always think of the Sean Bean Sharp's Rifle stories and the one where he goes to court and the guy's telling him, okay, you know, be careful when you back away that you don't trip over your sword. So I went to meet her because we hadn't met, and I knock on the door, and she answers it, and the first words out of her mouth were, "My God, you really are 24." I that sort of colored my whole relationship with publishing for a while, was that everybody thought I was far too young to be there. And, you know, John's younger than me, but it's not simply that. He's got a fire in him. You can see it. This is a guy who has ideas and passion, and is moving and working quickly. And I mean, if you've gone to the Mulholland blog, and I highly recommend that people visit it, because every day there's new content, And it's exciting. It's energizing just to see, you know, print like comics is going through spasmodically painful changes right now.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a guy who's heading up an imprint at a major publisher and is energizing it like nobody's business. I mean, he really is. There is a fire. And it's you can't be around that and not be affected by it, not be warmed by it. And in some cases, you know, if you're not careful, you'll get burned. But right now, it's doing a great job of heating me up and getting me going. You know, I'm as excited to write Alpha as I've been to write a novel in over a decade. I mean, I'm really looking forward to it. So, and that's due in no small part to the environment, to, I think, getting some things changed on my end. But it's also due in part to John. You know, he's just been great to engage with on this.
Well, and that leads me to another question in terms of the changes that are going on in publishing.
Mm-hmm.
Someone had asked about digital plans for your Oni stuff, but I want to also cover book stuff, you know, regular novel stuff too. But let's talk about comics first. Are there digital plans for your creator-owned stuff?
Yeah, Oni does intend to have a digital platform. My understanding is that's going to be unveiled some point, I suspect, by before the end of the year. I think the reason that Oni does not tend to do things, they very much are a measure twice, cut once company.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in the second measure right now, I think. So I know for a fact that once they launch the platform, yeah, my stuff will be available digitally. Stumptown will be digital. Queen and Country will be digital. Whiteout will be digital. Future work through them will have a digital distribution.
And the other question, too, going over to the Audible.com website, I was looking at the Atticus books that are available, and also your Perfect Dark initial vector book.
Yeah.
I see all those as audiobooks. Have Q&C books come out as audio?
No, none of the Q&C books were ever done as audiobooks. And it's interesting because one of the things I'll cough it up right now. I have been trying to figure out what's going on with audio rights to those books where the audio rights were never exercised. Because presumably, if they haven't been exercised at this point, I should be able to get them back. And if I can get them back, then, you know, hell, I'll do author readings and sell them through the website, you know, and do them at like $10 a pop or whatnot.
Cool.
I enjoy reading. It is an aspect of the novelist side of the career that I actually quite like. I like being able to do it when I'm on tour. In particular, I tend to, you know, when I'm actually doing the first event tomorrow night, Wednesday night, here in Portland at Murder by the Book. And I was actually struggling, am I going to read from Last Run, or am I actually going to read from Alpha? I tend to like to read something new. I tend to like to read the thing that I'm working on. I think that's more engaging, and I think it seems to me it's kind of like a bonus prize for coming, you know what I mean?
Because mm-hmm.
you get the book anyway. So here's the other thing. Here's the next thing.
Sure.
And I also find, just speaking personally and from my own process standpoint, when I'm working on a novel, the way I edit is I read it aloud. I do not, you know, obviously I write quietly, but the editing process, you know, after the day's quota is done, I'll print it, and the way I edit is by reading it aloud, and I find that helps my ear. It draws out the miscues. If I'm typing very quickly, and oftentimes I am, I'll do the writer's trap of using the same word three times in a paragraph. And again, if I'm reading aloud, I catch it. You really hear it. If you say door, he went to the door, he opened the door, he closed the door. It's like, wow, I need to fix that. So,
well, that's interesting too, because, and I wonder how much that plays in dialogue, because there is dialogue that, you know, reads wonderfully. And then when you do hear a narrator go verbatim, it gets clunky.
Yeah, very much so. Well, in some dialogue, I think, you know, shouldn't be spoken aloud. There are writers who will go nameless you know, who have had their dialogue adapted verbatim in some locations, and I've literally sat there cringing, going, oh, no, that works infinitely better when you hear it in your head. When you hear it spoken by somebody who's trying to sell it, it sounds horrible. One of the early sort of approaches to fiction that I was given, and I don't remember who presented this to me, I think it was back in college, but it was very simply that the dialogue in and of itself should express itself. You shouldn't have to write, you know, "I hate you," she said angrily. It should be, "I hate you," and you should hear the anger in it. And I find, again, reading it aloud, it makes it clear that way. But also, you know, I've always preferred author readings, because the author, if the author knows how to read, the author is going to be the definitive source for how the dialogue should sound. You know, they've heard it crystal clear in their head. They're going to be the ones most suited to replicate it. And, you know, there have been some really good audiobooks in my work, but there have also been readings done that completely miss the humor, you know, and that tends to be, I think, my biggest, I don't want to say complaint, because I really haven't complained about it, but I suppose it's my biggest regret in hearing some of these things, how they're adapted, that the humor is missed, that lines that I think read pretty clearly on the page and to the reader as wry or sardonic or ironic sometimes are delivered with such deadpan seriousness that I find it laughable. And, you know, if you're laughing at your own stuff, unless it's supposed to be funny, that's probably a bad sign.
Have they gotten better? Do you think you're...
Yeah, I think actually the BBC, I can't remember if it was BBC Audio, did like the last two Kodiaks, and I thought that they did a wonderful job on them.
Is that Jonathan Davis that narrates those?
I believe so. But I also find, frankly, I find it difficult to listen for the most part, mostly because I don't want to hear wrong notes. So rather than put myself in a position where I'll hear a wrong note and not be able to do anything about it, I'd much rather just not hear it and smile and nod and hope for the best.
That's funny. I never really put two and two together. I go to BBC 4 and BBC 7. Those are their drama channels, and they are available digitally. And sometimes I see that they are actual author narration, someone narrating a book rather than a full dramatized version of a story.
Yeah.
And I usually blow those off, never even thinking that they're probably audiobooks, and obviously they are.
Yeah. So they've done, I think, a very nice job so far. But, yeah, going back to the Queen and Country question, no, none of them have ever been done. I don't know why. I would presume it's because Bantam never sold the audio rights. But if I can somehow wrest those away, I would very much. You know, in my copious free time, I would love to see... I would love to see those up and available.
Well, let's switch to some questions from the fans.
All righty.
Diops. Good name, Diops. Diops wants to know, you've talked at length about the amount of research that you do. It never fails to come through in your writing, but the timeliness of your work, particularly Queen and Country, is another quality that makes it so compelling. Could you also talk about how you get your news?
How I get my news?
Yeah, which media and from what sources?
Oh, how I get my news? I pay attention. No, I'm honest to God, I pay attention. I think that is an enormous part. You know, it used to be that I read newspapers. Now I read them digitally. One of the things I loved about the Kindle when it first came out was that I was able to, you know, I could get a subscription to a bunch of international papers, and I find reading news outside of the U.S. helps me immeasurably in putting U.S. news in context.
Sure.
I listen to the radio a lot. I listen to NPR a lot. That's sort of the primary news intro source. And these days, I also, you know, have a variety of news feeds on my Google homepage and things like that. And I have tickers and I have crawls. And then there are certain websites that I go to. I tend to go to them less these days simply because it is, frankly, it's an issue of how much time you can put into it.
Sure.
There's a lot of information out there. But what normally happens is I'll hear a story and something in the story will trigger an interest or a question I have, and then I will chase it down. And I tend to try to look for multiple sources on stories. And if I can, look for international sources as well as national. So that there is, I don't want to use the term objectivity because I actually despise it in relation to the media. I think it's fallacious and I think it's dangerous. And I think this pretense of presenting objective news is, honestly, I think it's laughable at this time, at this point, as well as in many cases morally bankrupt. If you're reporting a story that says that suicide bombers attacked an aid station in Kandahar and killed 26 people, say, and for some reason you feel this needs to be reported without any sense of moral outrage, why is it wrong to be outraged by that? And by the, you know, the counter to that is we now have gone from a pretense of objectivity to a gross pretense of objectivity that is entirely politically slanted both on the left and the right.
Sure.
In this country. And it's getting more and more muddled and I think more and more dangerous. And I don't like that. I mean, personally, I don't like that. The idea of the objective journalist, I think, is, it's like Schrodinger's, you know, cat. You can't, you know, the second you are observing it, you are a part of it. And I just, I really don't like this rather, I think, it, like I said, I think it's a very false effort to attempt to remove any sort of moral oversight or, I guess, compass to it. And people tend to, and I guess the counter argument is, well, that's judgmental or that's culturally insensitive or whatnot. And my response to that is bullshit. I mean, no, but bullshit. You can't tell me, look, you know what? I mean, it may be perfectly legal in Saudi Arabia to stone a woman because she was driving, but you can't tell me that, therefore, I can't be morally outraged, or therefore, we shouldn't be morally outraged. It is morally outrageous. It
yeah.
is morally outrageous. I'm sorry.
Right. Well, I agree. I agree with those kinds of things.
You can dress it up as a religious issue. You can dress it up as a cultural issue. But at the end of the day, it's still morally outrageous. I get this all the time. You know, all these stories about China in the news, and in particular, NPR does this. They bend over backwards. And every now and then, they'll mention, "Oh, by the way, it's a totalitarian regime." It's like, "Oh, is it now? Really?"
Was
Don't
it in...
you think that kind of influences everything? There was a story today, right,
okay,
about the premier and how he's been giving a lot of lip service to political becoming more progressive, and I think even using, you know, the word democratic reforms. And it was the first time in ages that I've ever heard anybody reporting on China that said, "But yes, basically that's bullshit." You know, this is a hardliner, and nobody for a minute believes what he's saying is what he's actually going to do. But for the most part, the news doesn't respond to that, and the news doesn't talk about it. And it seems to me, you know, this is one of the reasons why we get complacent, and then we get anger directed in entirely wrong directions, I think.
Well, that's interesting.
Talk about a tangent.
No, and I'm glad you said that. And that's interesting because I read one of the Chinese stories today about the bullet train and how they were so, you know, impressed with their technology and look at these advancements that we made. And sure enough, at the bottom of the story, it did say, yeah, by the way, one thing that wasn't mentioned by the official press release was the likelihood of live sacrifice to you know, enable the technology to get where it is. And you know, it is it did play to the conditions of China, and that obviously they take risks that we are not willing to take with our people. Just because of, you know, it's we have a bigger moral problem than the Chinese do about it.
Well, and I think a lot of it is also, you know, in particular, the last run is so much about Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of reading and a lot of research. And one of the other things I do for research is I tend to, I've actually used for the last two books a very able gentleman by the name of Tim O'Brien, who I can call up and say, okay, Tim, I need everything you can find me on the Iran secret police, and I need an overview primer on the country so that, you know, he can give me 2 weeks later a document that has multiple citations and is basically, it's basically, you know, somebody's term paper. And like, this is modern Iran. And then I can work off of that, and I tend to use that as both a supplemental and a launching point in many cases. And one of the things that comes up when you're looking at Iran, you know, and, you know, there's a reason Ahmadinejad has been so fantastically successful, because he is pen to the Iranian government's teller. You know, he's over here making all this noise and waving his hands and being really big on stage, and they're over here going, well, actually, we're going to start funding some more groups in Lebanon, and let's see what we can do to destabilize Afghanistan further and make sure that the Turks are really scared of the Kurds so that we can maintain oil supremacy in the region. Right? But that's not the news, right? The news is Ahmadinejad went to the UN and said, kill the Jews!
Right. Yeah, it's the outrageous statement.
What makes better copy?
You know? Right. Well,
and
yeah.
The media loves it. They jump on him. They jump on him. And he is absolutely the working example of the wizard in the Wizard of Oz. You know, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Or the mullahs behind the curtain, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I worry sometimes about where media is going. You know, I do.
Only sometimes?
Well, you know, yeah. Well, obviously.
you
know.
Work in it, John.
I was wondering what that daily stomach ache was.
I sweat every morning.
You know, I won't deny it. But, yeah, it's... it is getting the right information, and it just seems like it's more and more of a challenge for the average person, and well, to know where to go to get the right information.
One of the wonderful things that the internet has brought us is as much as you can find every nut job, you know, every nut job in the world has a web page now, but there are some real voices, and it takes some looking. But if you bring a critical eye to what you read, and if you ask questions of what you read, and then try to find answers to those questions, the material is out there. And I don't, you know, I'm very left. I'm very pinko. But you know, left media, left leaning media, and right leaning media both have sane voices present.
Absolutely.
They also have crazy voices.
Absolutely.
And you have to be able to know, okay, this one is entirely pursuing an agenda. This is punditry rather than reportage. And, you know, you have to put in the hours to find the facts. This is the Aaron Sorkin line from which movie was the I want to say, like, The American President.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that speech that the president gives, and he talks about how this is advanced stuff, democracy. It isn't easy, and it isn't simple. And I think, frankly, the biggest thing, you know, now, you know, we're looking at an election season, and this election season is driven entirely by a conflict between people wanting it to be easy and the reality of the situation, which is, nothing can be easy in this day and age. In the state of the world today, economically, security-wise, environmentally, it is not easy. there is no easy to be found right now.
But where is that honest counter-argument to that, you know, simpler time?
The honest counter-argument is made. People are making it, but they're not being heard. They're being shouted out. They're being shouted out on, you know, once again, by simple one-note issues. And, you know, there's a reason that French unions have been on strike for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And it's not because the French are lazy, and it's not because the French are looking, you know, and going, oh, you can't change our way of life. The situation, you know, whether or not you agree with what Sarkozy is trying to do, or actually pretty much has succeeded in doing at this point, there are legitimate grievances saying, you know, if you make me retire at 62 and my job up until 62 is to, you know, is to work with hazardous materials every day, that is a different pressure you're putting on me than the guy who has worked in an office as, you know, an insurance adjuster until he's 62. And there's a legitimate grievance there. The flip side is it's not as simple as going, well, what would be fair when the whole economic precipice or the structure that is, you know, the French economy right now is in danger of collapse. And you're seeing it again in England, you know. And we have a lot of lip service going on in this country, and we don't have a lot of people who are willing to bite the bullet. And the Obama administration, you know, they used up so much of their political capital getting things accomplished that they said they would get accomplished. And again, people seem to think that, well, it should all be better by now. And all I can think is it took years for us to get into the state we're in. And people expect a magic wand solution. That's naive.
Yeah.
I mean, regardless of whether you're voting Democrat, Republican, Green, Independent, whatever, it is naive to expect that 2 years after a man goes into office, he will have solved everything. That's just dumb. That's just dumb. And when you look at the state of our country in relationship to the rest of the world, it becomes not just dumb, it becomes incredibly dumb. Because what we are struggling with here is a global problem, you know. But
yep.
There is, I think, an overriding desire. People want it simple, or they don't want to know. And trust me, I understand not wanting to know. The news is unrelentingly bleak these days.
And there are those who I sympathize with those as well, who say, hey, you know, I'd love to be able to sit down and read the news every day and be better informed. I got to pay my bills. I got to watch what my kids are doing. And boy, you know, I'll tell you, this is welcome to the Pinko Show, because I'm going to quote Bill Maher, and it's something that he said that I agree with in terms of, I get that not everyone can read the papers. Please at least listen to the people who are reading the papers,
yeah,
or who are really, you know, learning about the facts behind things and telling you that it is more difficult. Because
you know, and it's not even, and again, I don't even think it's a pink, you know, a pinko, it's not left or right. What it comes down to is listen critically.
Fair enough, absolutely.
Listen critically, and it doesn't matter what your political bent is, you know, it matters whether or not you are going to be intellectually lazy. And that's an entirely different thing than not having enough time to read the paper. I can understand that. I can understand that. You know, my mother, God bless her, you know, I was on the phone with her 2 nights ago, and I said, how are you doing? She says, oh, I have so much reading I have to do. this is the song my mom has sung since I was born. You know, my mother is responsible for me being a writer inadvertently. She was a journalist. But I grew up, you know, in a house where I can remember playing at one end of the house and hearing her electric typewriter going like a machine gun, you know, just like bullet, 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 ding, reload, you know?
Yep.
And it was a magical sound, and that drew me in. I mean, I knew, well, what are you doing? I am writing. Oh, that's what that act is. But she, you know, she reads 2, 3, 4 papers a day if she can. And yeah, you know what? She doesn't have enough time to do it. But that is her thing.
Sure.
Not everybody is going to be like her, and I recognize that. But everybody has an ability to think critically. Everybody does. And the thing that just drives me crazy, consistently crazy, is I hate lazy thinking. I hate it. I just hate it. You know, you got the brains. Fucking use them. If you're not going to use them, shut up and sit down. You forfeit your right to engage in the discourse if you can't be bothered to think about what it is you're going to say. You know?
Absolutely.
And I suppose in that sense, I am an incredible, you know, I'm an intellectual elitist.
Well, I was going to say, we had Noam Chomsky later on Word Balloon. And,
but see, the flip side is this. I'm an intellectual elitist, but I'm also, you know, an intellectual humanist. Everybody has this capacity. Everybody should do it. You know, my best friend in the world, you know, he and I argue politics all the time. All the time. You know, one of my other best friends in the world is about as far to the right as I am to the left, argue all the time. You know, I would still take a bullet for this guy. You know, different points of view don't have to, but we don't have to salt the earth. And, you know, that goes to another issue, especially dealing with politics in this country where, you know, it used to be, the quote was, what, politics is the art of, you know, everybody leaving the table unhappy.
Right, compromise, right? Yeah.
Yeah, nobody gets what they want, everybody gets what they can live with. And that died in the 90s. That died in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
It vanished. And it became an all-or-nothing game. It became a game of, you know, if I can't have it my way, fuck you.
Right.
And, well, guess what? The country suffers. The country suffers. You know, you look at the numbers, you look at poll numbers, you look at, quote, red state and blue state, and we are a pretty much evenly divided society. That requires compromise. That doesn't require more divisiveness.
Well, that,
I guess we're talking about this, you know, Saturday is the, you know, rally to restore sanity and or fear.
Yes.
So I think there's a legitimacy to that.
Well, and things are cyclical. I mean, this happened to both previous administrations, the Clinton administration and the Bush administration.
Yep.
And, you know, when, you know, the change happens in the legislature, we will see one of two things. We'll either see a stone wall or we will see a few things accomplished.
Yeah.
And right or wrong, or whether you agree with them or not, things did happen with, you know, Clinton and the Republicans working together in the 90s, welfare reform and things like that. And the same can be said for Bush. And the only thing I can think of is Medicare reform. So we're at these reforms of entitlements. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what Obama is able to accomplish moving forward.
Yeah. Well,
and we'll leave it at that and now move on to lighter things.
I think for everybody who's fast forwarded now, at minute 17, you can come back in. And you might want a time signature when we start this discussion.
There you go.
We might
actually do that for our more politically sensitive people and welcome you back. Hey, nice to see you. You know something? We sang a few songs and, you know, we talked a little bit about our favorite cartoons. But now we're back to the questions. All right, here we go. Dr. Colossus, fantastic. And now on to Dr. Colossus.
There you go.
Are there any artists out there that you would like to work with that you haven't had a chance to already?
Yeah.
any names?
There are several. No, I'm not going to name names. Because
okay.
It's the same thing. And if another question down there is, what are you reading now? I'm going to take a pass on that, too.
Fair enough.
Because I always will forget somebody, and I will always insult somebody in so doing, and I won't do that. Yes, there are artists out there that I have not worked with that I would love to work with. There are some that I've been flirting with for a while, and it really is like flirting. You know, it's like you see them across the comic book, and you kind of match eyes and then look coyly away. And there are artists that I would love to work with again, you know, that I've gotten to work with for a little while.
That's what I was going to say. I can think of a long list of people that you've only done one or two stories with that I would love to see you back. Someone asked about Steve Lieber as well. C. Funk was wondering if you and Steve might be working together again in the future.
Well, you know, there is still White Out Night, and it is still on my agenda. I'd actually thought I would get back to it prior to starting the novel, and I just didn't have time. So I'm hoping that after Alpha is in, I'll be able to go back to it and finish up Night, because Steve drew the first issue, and he drew the first 7 pages of the second issue, and then he stopped, and the reason he stopped is because I didn't give him any more script.
Okay.
And that's my fault, not his. We haven't actually spoken in a while. It's funny, you know, he lives here in Portland, but I think he and I tend to speak more when we see each other at shows than we ever do when we're in town. But the last time he and I talked, it was, you know, he wanted to do it. He was still interested, and I want to finish the Carrie's story up there. You know, Night is the last Carrie Stetko story, and if for no other reason than I desire that sense of closure, I want to finish it, and there's nobody else who can draw it. I mean, it is quite literally, Steve draws it or it never is seen.
Understood. I want to credit R.J. Spring for asking the digital Oni question earlier. I didn't do that.
All right.
And I see that on my list, so I thank
you.
Thank
you, R.J.
Absolutely. Now, we don't want to talk about things you're reading, but and you say that it is your television time is limited, but I was going to ask about this show as well, Rubicon on AMC.
You know, I didn't watch it, and I didn't watch it. I was going to, and I was warned off it. And I was warned off it by two sources that I actually trusted, though I saw recently several people saying, wow, it got a whole lot better at the end of the season. I guess it was a slow burn.
It was a very slow burn. Because I dropped it, too.
Well, I mean, a slow burn is, you know, frankly, I like slow burns. I like, especially in espionage stories, I like my espionage stories to be, you know, I think as much as I love Le Carré, and as much as there are things Le Carré does that I hate, I love Smiley's People because it starts so innocuously. It starts with such a small thing. It starts with the death of an old agent and a negative. Actually, a negative of two pictures. And from there, you know, That leads to checkmate on Smiley's, you know, arch enemy. So I dig stories like that. I suspect it will get added to the instant queue when it is available. But I only started watching, for instance, Breaking Bad a couple months ago, and that was, you know, and I've been hearing people say, "This is amazing."
Oh, I know. I've had people yell at me for not watching it either.
Well, and I started watching it, and I'm almost done with the first season, because the other thing is it takes time to watch.
Sure.
You know, and I tend to use that time for other things. So I actually tend to do a lot of my TV catch-up when I'm traveling. I tend to, you know, watch stuff on a plane or watch it in the hotel room if I find I can't work. And I've got a fair amount of travel coming up in the next 2 weeks, so I expect I'm going to be catching up on Breaking Bad. But yeah, I started watching. I was like, well, now I understand what people were, you know, going nuts about. This is amazingly good.
And it is pretty cool that Cranston, you know, I mean, that is the same guy,
yeah,
you know, well, that has been such an effective comedic actor for so long.
I've always thought he was a phenomenal performer. So I love the very twisted, very black humor of Breaking Bad. I think that is. I think there's something very courageous in that writing.
And it's interesting how AMC has really morphed from what was once a decent, you know, classic movies station to a long period in the woods when we were getting the crappiest movies.
Yeah.
And now it has become this great original content, you know, station, that these great series. And that's, I'm really happy for Kirkman. We're talking,
God,
on the eve of Walking Dead.
I know. I mean, wow.
And Darabont, I know, and Frank Darabont to be behind it and everything. I mean,
yeah.
Can you ask for better? I don't think so.
No, I really don't. And I think that's, but see, I also think that's so enormously deserved. You know, I think that Robert has, you know, and I met him actually for the first time at San Diego.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, he and I actually, I don't think, had ever met before. So I speak as somebody who doesn't know him personally. I speak as an observer of his career, like most readers are. But I think he has done a masterful job, both in his art, you know, in the work that he has produced, and in how he has governed it, and controlled its growth and its exploitation. I think that is remarkably and brilliantly well handled. I am honestly I'm honestly more than a little impressed by it.
I quite agree. Dave Weil Goes. Or Dave Weil Goes. I know it's a hell of a name, Dave, but I hope I did okay. A lot of your peers have referred to you as the most technical writer they've ever met in a very positive manner. I was familiar with your work from things like 52, but I never read a lot of your solo stuff until Batwoman came out. And then I went on a Rucka binge, and I'm almost done with Gotham Central and Queen and Country, and couldn't be more bummed that I'm almost done. But upon reading these, it seems to me that more than a lot of your writers, you fully realize a story, striking a perfect balance between character and plot. And better than a lot of people, you find a way to give every artist the ability to play up to their strength, and then, in turn, they put 110% on the page, and you can tell. Can you elaborate on how you structure a story, how you go about collaborating so well with the artists that you work with? Thanks, Greg. I'm a huge fan of the stuff I've read so far. I can't wait to read more.
Oh, that's very flattering. That's a long question.
Yeah, you've covered some process already in terms of research, and we've also covered these in previous Word Balloons as well.
I think the biggest thing I do, if I do a thing when working with an artist on a story, is I guess the easiest way to put it is I try to respect them. I would not accept it if an artist came to me and said, "You wrote that wrong, and I'm going to rewrite your dialogue. I'm going to fix that for you," right? I tend to script. My scripts tend to focus on emotional action and plot beat. In fight sequences, I will sometimes break down specific move-to-move-to-move sequences.
Mm-hmm.
Because there needs to be a logical causality in a combat. But I actively very rarely script with an eye towards telling the artist, this is the image, and it has to be this image. I think that would be, and I've said this before, we've said this before in other interviews, but I think that would be incredibly arrogant of me to turn to somebody who has spent years honing the craft of visual storytelling and have me leap in and say, no. You know, after 10 plus years of doing this, I can look at a comic book page and I can look at a layout and I can look at a visual storytelling and say, this is flawed, this is not working here because of X, Y, or Z. But that is not the same as saying that it must be done my way or the highway. And I try to make that clear with every artist I work with. I think, we talked about it the last time we did a Word Balloon interview, I think, but, you know, that collaboration is nowhere more evident than in the Detective Comics stuff that I did with J.H.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was a whole new level of a collaboration. Prior to that, I tended to script, and conversations with the artists would be, and here's the script, and if you have questions, let's talk about it, but understand this is a structure, this is not the law. And with Jim, you know, he and I would talk about the issues for hours before I even started scripting, so that by the time, you know, he got script, it would be reading a shorthand. You know, I'd say, this is the lightning bolts we talked about.
You know? Right, right.
And anybody else who reads that is going to be like, what the fuck is he on about, lightning bolts? Jim reads that and he goes, right, this is okay. Now, the lightning bolts, we talked about this. I know this. This was the thing I wanted to do. And so I think that in that sense, you know, I always try to give the artist their due. That doesn't mean I'm not opinionated about what I like and what I don't, and it doesn't mean that I won't throw weight around if I feel I have to. And I guess by weight I mean only, you know, I will say this doesn't work for me or whatnot. But for the most part, I really do believe that you've got to trust your collaborators, and if that is a good collaboration, then that's a two-way street. That the artist is going to respect what you're trying to accomplish in the script and is going to try to serve that. And that, I suppose, is the heart of how I write. I want to make it clear, this is the story we are trying to tell. This is why these things in the story are important. These are the important moments. These are the things we need to hit. You know, I don't know what to make of being called the most, technical writer. I've always felt that I'm a character writer. I work from character first. Character drives story. Character dictates plot. You can have an event that starts your story, but different characters are going to respond in different ways to that event. And how those characters respond is the story. So,
did the good experience with J.H., influence what you're doing with Rick on American Soldier then, Rick Burkett?
Yeah. And talk about somebody that, you know, that's, you know, Rick and I communicate telepathically at times. I can give him a script and he knows exactly what it is I'm after. And he can know it in a way that I didn't know it. You know, I can give him a script and he can turn around and show me a page and the page will be exactly what I wanted in my mind's eye but could not articulate in the script. And I think, you know, that simply is he and I met a long time ago, and I think from the moment we met, we sort of looked at each other and we're like, we're kindred spirits. I mean, we have a lot of the same references and a lot of the same passions. And so, you know, a lot of how a comic script is written is referential, right? This is like that thing. Even if you're not actually saying in the script, this is like X sequence or Y sequence or this visual or that visual, all of these visuals are informed by other experience, other comics you've read or movies you've seen or books or plays or whatnot. And Rick and I, despite the difference in our age, I think share a remarkable, remarkable number of similar influences.
You know, I always forget that he did the Batman Adventures. The one thing that always stands in my mind that I loved was The Scavengers, a book he did with Christopher Mills. Mm-hmm. And it was only one issue, but it was such a great kind of noir look. And I can only imagine what he's going to do with a war story or whatever American Soldier is. You know, do you want to talk a little bit about American Soldier in pursuit of a publisher?
Well, the idea for it is, I mean, it's a very grand idea. The idea for American Soldier is to track American history through the service of one family so that we start in Revolution and we will then go to the War of 1812 with our protagonist's potentially great-great-grandson and to travel through up until the modern age, and to do this in individual volumes. That's sort of the gross idea of it. The more nuanced approach is, you know, that is in many ways the story of America. Our first guy and our last guy are separated by 200 plus years, and everything that's happened in the culture since then, and yet they're still bound by the same things, and they're still bound by that sense of service. So, you know, we start in 1776 with a guy named Jonas Lazar, who is actually a Portuguese Jew whose family is in New York. And he ends up in Pennsylvania because there were Jewish families in Philadelphia that were trading partners. There weren't many Jewish enclaves in the colonies, but there was a community in Philadelphia, a community in New York, and a community, I want to think, in Maryland. You could not be Jewish in Massachusetts at the time. I mean, you literally couldn't be. It was like, you're Jewish, leave.
Wow.
And Jonas, you know, at the age of 16, goes to Philadelphia ostensibly to work with his other family, and ends up going into the backwoods on a trade gig, and stays. He effectively becomes a backwoodsman, one of the long rifle guys.
Mm-hmm.
And in February of 1776, he receives a letter basically saying that one of his older brothers has died, and he needs to come home. And he returns to New York about a week and a half before Washington and the Continental Army arrive, having broken the siege of Boston. And he arrives to find his brother's bride with their two kids, one of them newborn, and pretty much, as was custom at the time, knows that I need to marry this woman. So we have... And ironically, and this is one of the things I love about doing research, I was doing some digging around. Passover, right, the Jewish celebration of the liberation from slavery in Egypt, was the week before Washington arrived in New York.
Wow.
So he arrives suddenly finding, okay, I'm a family man, suddenly finding himself in the middle of this conflict, and very much at a point where the issue of being free and living free and securing a future for your progeny are all at the front of his mind. And he ends up in the Continental Army. And he ends up in the Continental Army as an officer because his deceased brother had an officer's coat. And there were many people who ended up as an officer because they had a coat and could thus be identified as such. So, you know, some of the things that you talk about a project like this, and it sounds like, well, it's going to be a travelogue of battles, but it can't be because that's not really a narrative. And frankly, and this is something Rick and I have wrestled with, you could spend 200 pages on any one of these battles, just 200 pages on the Battle of New York. Up until crossing the Delaware. That could be a whole 200 pages. So trying to frame these stories is another challenge. We start in 76. Well, the war doesn't end until, like, what, 89? I can't remember off the top of my head.
That sounds okay. Cornwallis, yeah, I want to say something like that.
Well, I'm going to kick myself because I should know this off the top of my head, and I don't.
Look it up.
This is the problem with doing research on other things, is that the research you did on the other project gets pushed aside. I'd have to check my notes. But you would think logically, well, you frame the story from the beginning of the conflict to the end of the conflict. That's a lot of time to cover.
Yeah.
And that in and of itself, again, does not a story make, because the plot, for lack of a better phrase, is the Revolutionary War. But the story is these two strangers essentially falling in love and needing to fall in love against this backdrop where he's not around a whole hell of a lot. And she's from Brazil. You know, she's a Portuguese Jew who came up from South America. She, you know, speaks Ladino and Portuguese, but her English isn't great. So here's this woman who has, you know, she's in a worse, far worse position. You know, what happens if he dies? Who is this guy? Is he going to treat me well? Is he going to treat his brother's children well? Will they be his children? So there's, you know, that's revolution. And then, 1812, I actually think we're going to do naval. I've had a hankering to do.
Cool.
I want to do really good naval battles. I've been racking my brains for years trying to figure out how you do a really good, honest-to-God Patrick O'Brien-esque, you know, Aubrey Matarin naval story as a graphic novel. How do you do that? As opposed to this Pirates of the Caribbean bullshit where you shoot cannons at a ship and they blow up.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
As opposed to the incredible technical skill and the drama. I mean, the incredible drama of needing to, you know, master an engagement over the course of 8 hours, 12 hours. Of the technical difficulty of, you know, again, you see your average pirate movie, and firing a cannon is a simple act of pointing and pulling. And it's that forgets one really crucial factor, which is the ocean is moving. It's not stable. So if you fire at the wrong time, your dead-on shot can sail over the ship by 20 feet. You know, I want to be able to, Rick and I have talked about wanting to illustrate that, wanting to illustrate how, you know, time during these battles is crucial, the amount of time that passes, the incredible intricacy of trying to have the wind before you have the engagement, you know, and the incredible amounts of maneuvering required to get the wind. So, I mean, you know, in my mind, I see these double-page foldouts, you know, that
wow.
are, you know, that are ostensibly would be a nautical map.
Sure.
You know, would look like a nautical sea chart, and you'd see like a compass maybe in a pencil and so on. And then on that, you'd have panels, and on the map, you would have sort of the dotted line motion and the hour markings as to where the ships are up until the point that they actually engage.
Fantastic.
But see, this is the sort of geeky stuff that I get really excited about, and I can hear the yawns.
Well,
okay. I'll pass on that.
You know, but I understand, and it's that futility of war, too, or trying to do something in war that I think Garth Ennis did really well in War Stories when he was mm-hmm. doing that series about 10 years ago. And I remember David Lloyd telling, and it was a World War II story, but still a very effective naval story with Garth in that series. So, but, you know, yeah, really, go back to the, you know, sailing technology and everything, and it's like,
well,
my God.
There are other things, I mean, that I do think that, you know, any nation's history is a history that's going to be bound in its conflicts. But I love the fact that, you know, I can start, you know, Rick and I can start in Volume 1. And Revolution, and have Jonas actually getting an order directly from Washington. You know?
Sure.
Washington will stop in front of him and say, "You stand there." And then we get to 2010, and, you know, if anybody's talking to Petraeus, it's because they did something really wrong.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? And I think, again, you know, it's just, it's a wonderful lens with which to view the history of the nation. So,
no, I understand, man, and it's it's an ambitious project. I hope you are able to find a publisher, and that's why I think it's interesting. And I'm a big fan of Rick's art too, so I think it would be a very interesting combination.
It really is. It is a project of passion. I'm really, really invested in doing it and doing it properly. And that's part of the reason, I think, why he and I have been so kind of careful about where we're going to take it. And it also, you know, it's not average fare. That's the other thing. It's not, I think there are a lot of publishers who look at that and go, is there a market for this? I don't know if there's a market for this. So.
No, I understand. And I know DC in its own way has been just exploring the war genre that they have and the characters that they have and stuff with one-shots.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, totally different animal and, you know.
Yeah. I will say I think some of those stories were an opportunity missed. I read some of them. And I think that there was some real, real beautiful opportunities entirely missed. And that's all I'll say on that.
Fair enough. Actually,
I'll add this. If you have Pete Tomasi working at your company, there is no excuse for doing a bad war story. There.
Yeah, Light Brigade, okay. Yeah.
So, no, I mean, I've talked to Pete about this. I mean, he is, I think Pete's a phenomenally talented writer, and there's no excuse. You know, if he's there under contract, then you should be having him write these things. So
I understand that. Yeah, it is interesting because, yeah, some guys I think were good fits, and some guys it was just an opportunity to give writers and artists a chance to do something. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. Well,
I'm not indicting all of them. I think a couple of them really missed the mark. And that's all I'm going to say on that.
All right.
Now I'm doing that thing where, Rucka didn't like, and somebody will be angry at me.
I've heard other negative comments about some of the DC War stuff, and that's fine, you know.
Yeah, you just haven't heard a Word Balloon podcast. Next.
No worries. I'm looking for next. I think we've covered all the questions. I'm looking here.
That's good.
No, the only other thing I wanted to ask is we wrap up Queen and Country for now, and talking about your choices for artists and stuff like that, how many of those did you really say that's the guy, or, you know, how was the process in choosing them going back to the beginning?
That was very much an Oni-driven process. I mean, we would sit down, and one of the things that happened very early on is that Rolston drew, you know, Broken Ground, and almost immediately artists that were working on other projects at Oni turned and said, I'd like to do a Queen and Country story. And I would get sketches sent to me. So I have, like, you know, sketches by all these different artists of their Taras and their Crockers and their so-ons. And that actually, you know, we ended up with a queue. So we had people lined up. And then I was able to talk. First it was Jamie Rich, and then it was James Lucas. And, you know, we would look at our art choices and be like, well, this would be a good match for this. Let's try something different for this. Let's see how this works. One of the things that Queen and Country was meant for me, rather selfishly at the start, was I wanted to work with a bunch of different artists because I wanted to see how different artists would take my words and how they would interpret them, how they would, you know, view the script. And further, I wanted to expose myself to different types of art. When you work in particular, you know, for Marvel or DC, in the main, there are really very few art styles at work. There is a standardized superhero house style. And there is variance within that style, but that's the style that's promoted. To get outside of that style, you tend to have to go to boutique projects. You have to go up to Vertigo or Shift, you know, to the more marginalized stories. So I wanted, for my own sake, to sort of broaden my horizon, if that made sense. And that was very deliberate.
Well, I think you've chosen some very interesting people to work with. Mm-hmm. And some were very young when they started with you and have their careers have flourished. I think of a guy like Chris Somney, who did the last arc, and, you know, look where he is now and look where his art is. And, you know, it's amazing because it there's definitely progression, but there really was great talent there when he did that story with you.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, I know Chris Niesman is another big fan of Somni's take on Queen and Country as well.
Yeah. I thought he did a wonderful job. But, I was blessed. I can honestly look back at the whole run.
Truly.
And there's not an artist I'm unhappy with. There's just not one.
And, you know, Carla, who would have thought Carla Speed McNeil would be, you know.
I loved what she did. And talk about exposing yourself to a different style, because I, you know, I had no idea what it was going to look like. It's just no idea. And, God, I loved that story.
It was really well
Jason
done.
Jason Alexander was another one, you know. I thought Jason has the distinction of having my favorite Queen and Country panel ever. He drew what to me is the quintessential Tara panel. And this is not to malign anybody else who ever worked on the book. It's simply to say, you know, he had the story that had the moment, and he nailed the moment. It's the moment when she's walking out of the hotel room after she's basically interrogated Anton. And Anton is, what should I do? And she stops in the doorway, and she lights a cigarette, and she looks back at him. And the way he did the panel, he shot it as a POV, so it's an up angle of her with the cigarette in her hand looking down at him, and she says, shoot yourself, and walks out. I was like, that's her. Right there. That's her.
And that's, by the way, kids, Operation Blackwall. That Jason drew. So that's one of the volumes you can look for. Of course, get the definitive editions, and you'll find them all there. You know, but yeah, I mean, Brian O'Malley, Brian Hurt, Mike Norton. Yeah. You know, by the way, too, the people who've asked process questions today, and I didn't get to a lot of those. I do think that your script book for Queen and Country is a great place to start. And you, now your process has changed since then. Is it time for a new script book for something to kind of analyze?
I've actually thought about just throwing up some PDFs on the website and let people say, here, take a look. I suspect maybe there's, like I said, the project of which I cannot speak that will hopefully be out in 2012. I think when that rolls, that'll be a really good time for me to put together like a script book and say this is the progression of how I've scripted, and throw in, you know, at the start, this is Whiteout, you know, back in 99. This is how I wrote a script in 99. And this is how I write a script in 2012. And one of the things I think makes the Queen and Country script book actually something that I'm quite proud of is I like the footnotes in it. I think putting up a script is not enough. I think for people who are curious about the process, they deserve more than that. And I want to be able to annotate them. So that would be the next. If there is ever another script book, it will be another annotated script book.
Sounds good. Very cool. Well, as always, I think we've covered good ground. And I think we can leave it here for now.
Alrighty.
But no, thanks for taking the time, and I know the Word Balloon listeners appreciate you answering questions as always.
Well, it's I say this every time, but it's always a delight to talk to you. You make it very easy.
Well, likewise, my friend. The last run again, go out and get it, folks. And we talk about some other Word Balloon products, or I should say, Greg Rucka products in our sponsorship today. Make sure you check those out as well.
And tour information is at gregrucka.com. So
the link is there.
Yeah, as well as the book plate offer.
That's right. Don't forget. So make sure you take advantage of that. And details, if you're not going to be at a book signing, Greg tells you how to get those taken care of as well. Thank
All
you,
right,
sir.
John. Thank you very much.
And that'll do it. That was the Rucka Debrief. I hope you enjoyed it. A great talk with Greg, and looking forward to the future projects. And we'll catch up with him when there are announcements to be made. Today's episode of Word Balloon was brought to you by Audible.com. Don't forget, for a free 14-day trial, for your chance to check out their service, go to audiblepodcast.com/wordballoon. And you get a free audiobook, and we talked about this before. You can get two of Greg's Atticus Kodiak novels, both Patriot Acts and The Walking Dead, are available at audible.com. They're $7.49, but in this 14-day trial, you can get it for free, and if you don't like the service, you get to keep the book. Check it out for yourself. Go to audiblepodcast.com/wordballoon. That's audiblepodcast.com/wordballoon for your free audiobook. John Suntra saying thanks again for listening. Don't forget to follow us in the various ways here at Word Balloon. You can follow me on Twitter under my name, John Word Balloon. Of course, we're at wordballoon.com. Every Tuesday, we have a new episode at iFanboy. Sometimes when we have a two-part episode, it happens more than once a week, for example, today. And questions or comments about the show, you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com, or you can follow me on Facebook and throw me a message there under my name, John Suntress. If you enjoy the show and don't want to miss an episode and also enjoy some bonus content as well, there's the Word Balloon app. It's available at the iTunes store. And with the Christmas season coming, keep listening to Word Balloon, because we're going to have a nice little gift available for people who may want to say it with Word Balloon this Christmas, and something that you might want for yourself as well. We'll talk about that when it is in hand, but very excited about one of the products coming from Word Balloon. Until next time, thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2010.